did you find this?
Hello, Craig.
It's not Ladies' Night.
If you guys, it is not Ladies' Night. And we just finished recording last week's marathon episode about 3 hours ago.
It was that long. And you know what, guys? It's over.
It's, you know what, though? I have a feeling we're going to be so back by the end of it.
We're back. Darren Waller's over.
Yeah. It's done. It's done.
Yep.
Was it officially official?
Yep. He's placed on the list. He's done.
All right. So what is our new segment going to be?
Jerry Jones.
Yeah. Jerry Jones Death Watch.
Okay. I don't know if you follow him, Shane, but I'm sure Tony probably does on Twitter. Tim Heidecker. He's currently in the midst of doing a Jimmy Carter watch, and he'll every like once a week, he'll just post like Jimmy Carter watch, current change in status, nothing.
I don't know how he's still alive either, dude. Like,
I don't know.
Reanimated corpse.
Yeah. He's like the lawful good version of Prince Philip.
Yeah.
True.
Should we do also Robert Kraft? Because I was watching, I get the Edelman podcast on my YouTube short recommendations all the time. Okay. And I'm like, man, these Patriot players have like a God complex about this human trafficker.
Yeah, he's a bad dude.
Like, they call him Mr. Kraft. I'm like, you're a 40-year-old adult. He's fucking Robert. It's fine.
He's not paying you anymore.
Yeah, who gives a shit?
Yeah. Surprised they don't call him Dr. Kraft.
If you pay my checks, I'll give you the full title. If you're the one that signs my checks, that's fine.
But if you're on jury duty, bro, I had this happen to me one time. They're like, would you have a problem with calling this person by the first name? And I was like, what do you mean? They're like, yeah, would you have a problem? Because I think I was 25 at the time. And they're like, yeah, like, would you have a problem calling that guy like Frank? I was like, no, I'm not a weirdo. I'm like, G.I. Joe over there might care more than I do. And then I got kicked off the question thing.
That's awesome. How fun. It's episode 137? It's 137.
Numbers are fake, bro. We're just here for team previews.
That's true. We've been doing this for a long time. Great job, guys. We got another jam-packed episode. So let's not waste any time. Ryan, why don't you set this shit off?
Guys, guess what? I'm doing another tight end this week.
No way, dude.
Someone who played for Dallas, let's see, 70s and 80s, considered one of the best tight ends to ever play at Michigan State University. I want to talk about Billy Joe Dupree.
What a name. That's a Cowboys name.
Yeah, for real. He was born with a cowboy hat.
He was born in Louisiana, so kind of close. Went to West Monroe High School. And if you know anything about Duck Dynasty, you know that's where the Robertson family lives, is in West Monroe, Louisiana.
Yeah, if you know anything about Duck Dynasty, let me tell you.
That's right. So as I said, he went to that high school, played basketball, baseball, and football. They're only a class 2A state champion, though. Small town.
Does that mean like JV?
No, so the divisions are set by the district size of the schools school plays in.
So if you got 50 players in your entire campus, like, well, you don't got enough, so here you go.
Yeah.
So as we all know, Michigan State is, well, at least, I don't know about recently, but back then was more of a run-oriented offense. And you'll kind of wonder why he's considered Michigan State's best tight end in school history. When you hear some of his numbers, you're like, well, that's really not that great. But it was, I guess, if you're in that system. So he went in and as a freshman and as a sophomore, he was named the starting tight end. He ranked second on the team, with 21 receptions for 402 yards and 3 touchdowns. A 19.1 yard average, though.
The world has changed so much, and the Big Ten in terms of football will always be the same.
Right. As a junior, he did a little bit better. All right. He went from 21 to 25 catches for 414 yards and another 3 touchdowns. That led the team that year in catches and yards.
Woohoo!
Yikes.
Yeah. He was a co-captain his senior year and started all 11 games. And yeah, the offense they were running was called the Wishbone T offense.
Sure.
Tony, can you explain that?
Yes. So it's quarterback under center, and behind him are three guys, but like one is angled underneath, so it's kind of like looks like an I don't know. I'd have to show you.
Like a Y.
Like an F kind of.
Oh, for failure of an offense.
Yeah, it's definitely stupid.
So he was mainly blocking that year, but get this, he caught more than half of the team's catches that year. All right.
12.
As a team, there was only 44 passes. Jesus. He caught 23 of them. Jeez. For 406 yards.
Jesus.
Yeah. But surprisingly, he did not get any touchdowns that season. He was the last tight end to lead Michigan State University in receiving, doing it in each of his last two seasons. He finished his collegiate career with 69 receptions. That's third in school history. For 1,222 yards and a 17.7 average and only 6 touchdowns. He did play basketball for one season for them too. But in 1973, Tom Landry, you know, was in his like fourth decade of coaching and decided to take Dupree 20th overall in the 1973 NFL draft.
Oh, so he's senile.
I love when old people do shit like that, dude.
He became an immediate starter, which says at the time was almost unheard of on a Tom Landry coach team. I'm guessing he wanted you to, you know, fight for that position, but
right.
I don't know. He made him a starter. Mike Ditka gave Dupree his jersey number 89 to wear. Cause at the time Ditka retired as a Dallas Cowboy, which was, that was weird. He led the team in receiving yards with 392 and was second in catches with 29 and 5 touchdowns. He set a franchise record for tight ends with 3 touchdown catches in a single game against St. Louis Cardinals.
Okay, that's wrong.
That's his freshman. That's his first year in the NFL.
Okay.
74, he had 29 receptions, a little over 400 yards. 75, he had some injuries. He did play in all 14 games, though, but he only started 6 times. Let's see. In 1976, Gene Fugit left under free agency, and Dupree once again was the starting tight end. He had 42 catches, which at the time was a franchise record for tight ends, and good for second on the team. He also had 680 yards that year. He was named to first of his 3 consecutive Pro Bowls. 77, Cowboys kind of went back to a more run scheme, and he was reverted to doing a lot of blocking. Only had 28 receptions that year. And yeah, even though tight ends during his era were expected to block more than feature their receiving skills, his 41 career touchdowns receptions was the Cowboys record for tight ends until it was broken by Jason Witten in 2012.
Damn.
Yep. In the 82 season, he helped block on Tony Dorsett's record 99-yard touchdown run against the Vikings and awesome. Immediately announced his retirement after that. He said that was it.
After the play. He's like, you know what? That's good.
Overall, he had 3,565 yards in his career, 42 touchdowns. He also rushed for almost 200 yards.
Damn.
And a touchdown on 28 carries. He never missed a game in his 11 seasons in the league. and was part of the franchise legacy of Pro Bowl tight ends that includes Jim Duran, Dick Bielski, Lee Fulkins, Mike Ditka, Jay Saldy, Doug Cosby, Jay Novacek, and Jason Witten. He was also recognized as the team's Man of the Year. He does charity work with the Shriners. He's in the MS. He drives one of those little carts.
Fuck yeah.
He's actually a great uncle to English rugby league footballer Tyler Dupree, who plays for the Wigan Warriors right now in the Super League.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah,
he's in the Louisiana Sports Hall of Fame, the Michigan State Athletics Hall of Fame, the Blue Gray Football Classic Hall of Fame, and he is an avid member of the Board of Trustees for the Meals on Wheels in Collin County, where he lives.
Oh, good shit. Good for him. Fuck yeah.
Right. Excellent tight end in a Cowboys offense. Not crazy numbers compared to Jimmy Graham, who we talked about last week. But at the time, was one of the greatest tight ends playing the game, Mr. Billy Joe Dupree.
He still has his brain too, though. So
seems like it.
When I am done with writing up all the team previews, I'm gonna try to figure out a math equation that we can use to weight out receiving production in football from the 70s. So it's like, you know, like a dollar conversion chart.
Like, oh, yeah, yeah. Inflation like 400 yards back in the 70s would have probably been like 900.
Then you put like Jerry Rice up there, right? Then it's like, then the rate goes through the roof where this dude's putting up like 4,000 yards in a season.
Yeah, but that's wide receiver numbers.
All right. So welcome to Back to Broncos Country. That's who I'm covering this week. So I got a shorty. A local guy for me who ties into 2 weeks ago about talking to the media. So I've got dual Hall of Famer and tackle Gary Zimmerman. So Zimmerman was born in Fullerton, which is where I went to college. Shout out to the administrator who I almost fought on graduation day in front of 2,000 people because he got my name wrong and didn't attempt to try it again.
Oh,
what a jackball.
Yeah. I almost swung on a 90-year-old jackball. Zimmerman went to Oregon, where he was All-American as a senior and would be drafted to the Los Angeles Express of the USFL 36th overall, but would also be drafted the Giants' third overall in the NFL supplemental draft in 1984. So this was a one-time draft that took place where the NFL could draft college seniors that were already signed to the USFL or CFL to prevent a bidding war between current NFL talent and people wanting to jump ship into the other leagues. NFL owners didn't want to waste real NFL picks on players that were already going to play somewhere else, but also didn't want to have a big influx of free agency talent in case one of the leagues collapsed. All this sounds pretty illegal, and in a way it was, because the CFL had a strict limitation on how many players could be drafted for each team to prevent litigation. So, of course, out of the 84 players selected, only 8 were from the CFL, and the remaining 76 were from the USFL, which goes to show you that rich people will do anything to benefit from themselves and sink the ship on someone else who wants to do something to protect the workers.
True.
So while playing for the Los Angeles Express, Zimmerman would be a teammate with future Hall of Famer Steve Young and farm prospect Steve Young. So he would play another year before Donald Trump killed the USFL and would join the Vikings, who obtained his rights from the Giants. So all awards dump here before we get to the lore of why he relates to the guy 2 weeks ago that we covered. So he's a Super Bowl champion, 3 first-team All-Pros, 2 second-team All-Pros, 7 Pro Bowls, all 80s and 90s decade team, USFL All-Star twice, Denver Ring of Honor, USFL Hall of Fame, Oregon Hall of Fame, and NFL Hall of Fame.
Damn.
So Zimmerman relates to someone we talked about 2 weeks ago because Zimmerman was notorious for never speaking to the media, just like Marshawn Lynch.
True.
So this happened because he got caught talking poorly about teammates after a loss, which came back to bite him because the team kind of did turn on him of like, hey, dude, you can't be shit talking us to the media. We're kind of all here. We're going to find out. So after that point, he basically boycotted the media at all points for his entire career, refusing to engage in any form of media for the rest of his career. And towards the end of his career in Denver, he was the oldest guy in the room and became the leader of the O-line and started the tradition of no offensive linemen talking to the media, and which ran from his retirement from 1997 to 2007 when the NFL implemented a specific rule that required all NFL players to talk to the media called the Broncos O-line rule.
Well, so wait. So this all started because he fucked up and said something that he shouldn't have said.
Correct.
And he's like, well, you guys are assholes for reporting on the dumb shit I said.
Yep. So he's like, I don't want to get caught in saying something stupid, so I'm just going to not participate. Which, like, kind of a growth experience, right? Of like, hey, I'm not going to take ownership of what I've done, but also I'm not going to let you catch me, because he did get gotted.
Yeah.
So this rule states that it is not permissible for a group of players to conduct a media boycott, and the league will not allow a group to use a spokesperson, and all players must be available to talk to the media once during practice and during sequential games.
Wow.
So thanks, Gary Zimmerman, for putting this rule into effect.
Zimmerman. Yeah, that's awesome. Fuck the media. They don't, whatever. Who cares? Who cares? They don't give real answers anyways.
Yeah, it's all coach speak. Apparently not this guy, though. He threw someone on the bus. But I mean, like, I don't know, man. That's like what happens when you answer candidly. You just got to understand, oh, they're not looking out for your best interest, so right. Who cares?
I would have just, if I was a part of the media, I would have just started asking like, like weird questions. I would have been like, do you know you share the same last name as Bob Dylan?
All right. Speaking of workers' rights, sharing a last name, a million awards, whatever. I have without a doubt the wildest story I've ever done. So before I start, let me kind of explain how I got here. You guys might remember a few weeks ago for episode 121 when I did the Staley swindle about the Decatur Staleys packing on extra games to win a championship. You guys remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So the team that they beat was from Buffalo. Now, they aren't the same lineage as the Bills, but like, who cares? We make the rules here. And I did some poking around for dudes that played for previous Buffalo teams. And I stumbled upon probably the most interesting dude I've ever heard of, regardless of why I was finding out about this person. A guy by the name of Paul Robeson. All right. Now, before we start, there's so much about this dude that he's absolutely worth his own podcast episode. So I'm going to miss some stuff. And if you're interested, I suggest go check him out on your own.
The name sounds familiar, unless...
You probably will know. We'll get there. So... Paul Robeson, born in 1898 in New Jersey. His dad was a preacher. His mom died in a house fire when he was 5. His dad was kicked out of his church for being a black man who advocated for the radical idea of not being racist. Pretty tough. Paul was an actor and football player in high school. He was valedictorian. He ends up getting accepted to Rutgers.
Okay.
While working as a waiter over the summer, he befriends Fritz Pollard, who would become the first ever black coach in American football.
Okay.
Now, he goes to Rutgers and is the third black man in the university's history because of woke, as you know. He also tries out for the football team and makes it, despite his teammates trying to beat his ass on every play because they were racist pricks. He actually even gets benched for a game his sophomore year. Because the opposing team refused to take the field against a team with a black man on it.
He's getting like the Caitlin Clark treatment.
I guess.
Hey, you know what? It's all relatable, right?
Oh my god. So
he's a little also bit different. I was just making a joke.
No, it's the same. It's the exact. It's a 1-to-1. So he's also on the debate team and the glee club, which we'll circle back to in a second. He finishes his college career going back and forth between college and home, caring for his sick dad and taking classes. He was a first-team All-American end in back-to-back seasons. And friend of the pod and pro football inventor Walter Camp.
I was going to say, oh, hell yeah.
Walter Camp once said he was the best end in the young history of the sport at the time.
Nice.
He also happens to be valedictorian at Rutgers. Suck it.
What? Damn.
Dude. We haven't even. This is still the intro. So he goes to law school in 1919 and coaches a college football team as a side gig before finishing his degree at Columbia in 1923.
Damn.
So now during this time when a black man in a racist country is studying law, he also meets his future wife, Essie Good, who is an impressive woman on her own. He makes his onstage debut in the theatrical production of Simon of Cyrene, and Fritz Pollard gets him to play professional football at the same time.
Damn.
What?
He has a 3-year career playing in Akron, Buffalo, and Milwaukee. And that's it for our football portion. Robeson retires from football and goes to London to perform on stage in a play called Taboo. He ends up getting the lead in a play called And I'm just reading the title here, okay? I'm not going to say a slur, but it's definitely written in, you know, not AAVI, like not white person talk. All God's...
You're a teacher. You're used to it.
This is my To Kill a Mockingbird moment. The play is called All God's Chillin' Got Wings. And there was a major controversy about it because the climactic scene is him, a black man who was forced into marrying a white woman, and castrates himself in the play.
What? How do you, like, all right, I'm not going to spoil the play, but, like, how do you portray that on, like, theater, right? You, like,
catch
you
up.
Drop, like, a bunch of walnuts on the stage.
So he starts to blow up as an actor. His wife quits her job as a surgeon to become his agent, and he starts starring in actual movies now, too. I mentioned earlier that he was a good singer because he was in the Glee Club, but now he's performing vocally for, like, black charity events all across the Northeast. He links up with a pianist, and they perform ad-libbed spirituals and become relatively important figures in the Harlem Renaissance.
Okay, so this is like the 30s, right?
Late 20s. And just so you know, Ryan, he's a bass baritone.
Does he know Fats Wallace from the movie Be Kind to Rewind?
I wish that was Jack Black's character's name. That'd be fun. So in 1928...
Fats Waller, sorry.
In 1928, he plays the role of Joe in a play called Showboat, and to this very day, his version of Old Man River is considered the standard and benchmark that we compare all future performances to.
Nice.
This Showboat run performs at Buckingham Palace and did a 350-show run in London.
Holy shit.
What?
Even while this is happening, he's denied seating at restaurants.
Dude, America.
Jesus.
He starts, well, he's in the UK now, so he's in an avant-garde Swiss film called Borderline, and then he goes on to be Othello in London.
What? He did Othello?
Dude, we still haven't even gotten to it yet. So he and his wife split here because he couldn't keep it in his pants not for long after the birth of his son, but he's also singing still, and he becomes one of the first people to do tracks at EMI Studios, which would eventually go on to be named Abbey Road.
Damn. Well, I mean, you said he was a bass baritone, so I'd imagine, you know, his voice is somewhat of a Barry White type thing. He probably made the ladies go crazy.
Oh, yeah. So in 1933, he and his wife reconcile. They come back to America, and he stars as Brutus in a film called The Emperor Jones. He is the only black man who would star in a major American film for another 20 years.
Wow.
What?
This next part sounds like a joke. I swear to God it's not. He has a crisis of conscience about the types of roles he's getting, but at this point he's considered one of the biggest international movie stars on earth. In 1935, he meets a fan and bonds with him about their love for the arts and hatred for fascism. That man's name was Albert Einstein.
What? So,
appreciate the meme, because for once it actually was Albert Einstein. He gets radicalized during the Spanish Civil War. His management is like, dude, you cannot get involved with the anti-fascist side. And he's like, I don't care. He sends songs and messages to the front lines. And he gives a line in an interview that becomes his epitaph. It's, quote, the artist must take sides. He must elect to fight for freedom or slavery. I have made my choice. I had no alternative. End quote.
That's what everybody should live their life.
That's on his gravestone?
Yep.
Nice.
He sings to the freedom fighters in the hospitals that are wounded, and he goes to the front lines to sing and boost morale.
Awesome.
He gets involved in Indian independence from the British when he's living in London, and he changes his entire career trajectory to work on projects and for people that are advocating for the rights of the oppressed across the world. He performs in pro-labor Irish plays, he becomes part of the African independence movement, and before World War II hits England, he goes back to Harlem. During a tour in 1940, the Beverly Wilshire Hotel was the only major LA hotel willing to accommodate him due to his race, but he had to pay extra and sign in under an assumed name. So when he was staying there, he dedicated 2 hours every afternoon to sitting in the lobby where he was recognized to ensure the next time black people come through, they have a place to stay.
Damn.
That's fucking hard. So he quits the movies because of the types of roles given to black actors, but is still the lead on Broadway's Othello. Now, the Broadway version of Othello goes for 296 shows.
Damn.
That is the all-time longest run for a Shakespeare play on Broadway, still to this day.
Damn, what was that, like 3 weeks?
So during this run, he finds time to meet with the heads of the MLB in an attempt to integrate the game.
Oh, damn.
Dude, yeah. He sings a song in English and Chinese on behalf of the Chinese people while they were getting genocided by the Japanese in the 40s. The song becomes the national anthem for China in 1949 after the Great Leap Forward. Robeson sent royalties to the original author's family for the rest of his life.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So we're still not even done. He met Truman and demanded anti-lynching laws be passed. Otherwise, black communities would defend themselves physically. And as a result of that comment, he was thrown out of the White House. The NAACP was furious that he implied violence directly to the face of the president. That's so tough. I love that. He speaks about the importance of trade unions and civil rights. He's singing union ballads to miners in Wales. He visits the Soviet Union in 1949, speaks at the Paris Peace Conference. You guys all know Joe McCarthy and the Red Scare. Part of the Red Scare was Joe McCarthy forcing Jackie Robinson to testify that Robeson was a communist. Jackie Robinson didn't snitch.
Whoa.
Robeson gets blacklisted by the House Un-American Activities Committee. His performances are canceled. The government took away his passport. He manages to speak in New York to the UN and says the way America allows lynching qualifies under the newly established rule of genocide. The blacklist means most of his movies and music are taken off the radio and out of the theaters. They took his name out of the college football record books.
What?
Isn't that fucked up?
It's amazing how nothing has changed.
Uh-huh. When he testifies before, finally in person, before the House Un-American Activities Committee, just straight pleads the fifth. That's in your face. So they ask him, talk about, you know, things that have never changed. If you like Soviet Russia so much, why didn't you stay there? And he replies with the hardest line in the game. Quote, because my father was a slave and my people died to build the United States, and I'm going to stay here and have a part of it just like you, and no fascist-minded people will drive me from it. End quote.
Fuck yeah.
Right? Left-wing worker record labels in the UK find recordings of him singing bangers like John Brown's Body, and they're huge over there. 1958, his passport is restored due to a 5-4 ruling in the Supreme Court's case of Kent versus Dulles.
Damn.
His shit went to the Supreme Court. They argued that withholding a passport from someone without a criminal conviction violates the Fifth Amendment, so suck it, fuck you, McCarthy.
True.
So he decides to perform Othello literally in Stratford-upon-Avon, Shakespeare's home. He kicks it with Nikola Khrushchev. He becomes the first black man to sing in St. Paul's Cathedral and the first black man to sing at the site that will eventually become the Sydney Opera House, but leaves there a hated man because he spent too much of his time speaking out about Aboriginal rights.
Wow.
This dude's a fucking king. He was diagnosed with operable cancer in 1959, but continues to perform. In 1961, at a party in Moscow, Robeson attempts suicide. To this day, and through up to the point where his son passed, I believe, his son was 100% convinced that the CIA and MI5 were poisoning him and that his symptoms were consistent with those who were mind pattern brainwashed by MKUltra.
Okay.
Which, would that surprise you at all?
I'm honestly surprised he made it this far. Like, considering how much shit he's done, like, I'm amazed he wasn't killed like 30 years beforehand.
You'll see a little bit why here coming up in a second. So he stayed in a sanitarium while he was going through his suicidal stuff in London. And he has a panic attack when he gets back from London. He's hospitalized again. They give him electroshock therapy for 2 years straight and no psychiatric help.
What?
And they let him out and he's a fucking zombie because they've been electrocuting his brain, right?
Right.
Yeah, they fried him.
Yeah. So he goes to East Berlin hospitals where they are pissed at the amount of drugs and brain frying that they did to him. And he recovers there for years before returning home. The reason why I don't think he was assassinated is because he gets asked by Bayard Rustin, who's like a low-key, huge, important part of the civil rights movement in America. Bayard Rustin's like, yo, we want you to be a part of the civil rights movement. And Paul Robeson is like, sorry, bro. I refuse to denounce Marxism. So, and the civil rights movement was like, yo, you can't be this loudly communist and be part of the civil rights movement. And he's like, then I guess I'm not part of it.
Wow.
His wife passes away in 1965. He moves in with his kid and his family in Philadelphia. And Paul Robeson passes away in 1976 at the age of 77.
What a life. Now,
before we go, I want to do some Paul Robeson stat porn. Paul Robeson had the longest Shakespeare run in Broadway's history. He got an award from the UN in 1978 for his work to end apartheid in South Africa. He has a Hollywood Walk of Fame star. A 1980 documentary about his life won an Academy Award. A jazz poetry opera about his life just premiered in May of this year, and the Chicago run premiered on the 7th of June. He put out 16 films, 66 albums, 195 singles. He was inducted into the College Football Hall of Fame in 1995. He has a stamp with his face on it. He has his own Criterion Collection box set. The Soviet Union named a tomato after him, and three university libraries are named after him, too.
Damn.
I have one last thing, and I had to just include it. The apartment building he lived in during the 1940s is registered as a National Historic Landmark on Edgecombe Avenue.
Whoa!
What?
Unfortunately for you, it has since been renamed Paul Robeson Boulevard.
It'll always be Edgecombe Avenue to me.
So that's Paul Robeson, man. Holy fucking shit.
Wait, what city was that in?
New York.
Okay. Cause yeah, I was there's a county in North Carolina, Edgecombe County. And then there's also the town of Edgecombe in Maine. So I was wondering if it was out there, but yeah.
Dude, that's three cities for your bit one day again when we go back to doing towns.
That's yeah, true. Well, I've actually been to the city of Edgecombe when I was a teenager. My dad took us out there on like a gag. We went to Maine for a few days and he's like, let's go see the town of Edgecombe. It was actually really cool. But when you look up stuff about it, they're like the famous thing about that city is it's to this day, it still has a old like wooden shipwreck from the late 1700s, like in the bay. And it's a famous like, oh, so what did this ship do? It was it carried back guano from between here and, you know, England. Like, oh, great.
It's the wreck of the Edgecombe Fitzgerald.
Yeah, basically.
Thank you.
I just love stuff like that because someone's like, we'll get to it tomorrow. And they're like, you know what? National treasure. We're never to clean up that trash.
Yep.
But yeah, I just pulled up Paul Robeson's songs, so I'm going to listen to those later tonight.
Yeah, they're great. They're fucking great. His Union stuff is great too.
Yeah, so, I'm going to look more into this guy. I didn't realize that guy lived such an interesting life.
I suggest to start with his version of Old Man River. It's fucking sick.
That's the first one that came up.
Yeah.
And there's Land of My Fathers. There's actually, here's a clip on YouTube of him singing to the Scottish miners like you were talking about.
It's so dope. Fucking. Yeah. So it ties into Shane's shitting on workers conversation. Sure. Ties into Edgecombe Avenue. So here we are, Paul Robeson, uniting the people. So we're going to go. I'm doing it. I'm just hammering it out. It's Buffalo. It's the Buffalo Bills. You guys ready?
Yay.
Let's do it. Josh Allen time.
I have a secret for you.
Oh, no.
Josh Allen, QB1.
This is the first one I'm doing where I have a certified Tony sleeper.
What?
Because
Dawson Knox.
Shut up. Because like, look, dude, I think Jalen Warren's going to do great, but like he's running back 22, whatever, doesn't matter. So we'll get to the sleeper. So let's recap Buffalo real quick. For the third time in 4 years, the Bills were eliminated from the playoffs by the right hand of the older brother of Jackson Mahomes.
God, that sucks so bad.
Yep, he's dancing on their grave every year. I have to be real with you guys. The biggest move here in this offseason happened last year when Ken Dorsey was canned after week 10 and Joe Brady was moved up to interim OC.
Inshallah, brother.
Okay. Right? So what really happened in Tower 7? So once Brady took over, the offense changed. From week 11 through the divisional round loss to Kansas City, Buffalo was second in the league in run percentage. Second. Okay. And they were 26th for the first 10 games of the season. Now, let's not get too far ahead of ourselves here. We got to call it what it is. The Bills are trying to retool on the fly after getting their fingers caught in the closing of their first championship window with Josh Allen. They've moved off a ton of guys. Obviously, Stephon Diggs and Gabe Davis are gone, but so are key pieces like center Mitch Morse. You got Jordan Poyer, Ryan Bates. This team has created an artificial scarcity in order to give themselves one more solid cycle run at a title during Josh Allen's career. Now, I bootleg sports, Brett Coleman stuff. Shane, have you seen, has it crossed your YouTube? They're doing their team previews.
Not yet, no.
It's good. They're good. They just did the Bills one today, so I watched it, and I'm like, cool. This dude will have, like, I'll have a better idea what consensus looks like on the Bills from watching this.
I also like to, like, do our own thing first and then go back because I don't want to go in with a bias, right? I just want to look at, like, sure. the data and make our calculations and then figure it out from there and then be like, well, absolutely. Wow, I missed that one.
Well, I was really glad that I had already written this before I watched that one. So, like, I to see, because he's like, I don't really think they're retooling. Bro, they're retooling. They also said that, like, GM Brandon Bean's doing a good job through the draft. I could not disagree with you more. Since since 2018, so everything after Josh Allen was drafted, players drafted by Buffalo have a combined 2 Pro Bowl appearances.
Yeah.
James Cook and Dawson Knox.
Damn.
They haven't drafted a guy who has led his positional group in snaps for a single season since Greg Rousseau in 2021. Now, to fix things, they hired a new head of college scouting in May. To cover up the cap and beyond, the Bills are hoping some of their depth picks up where the old guys left off, like second-year guard Osiris Torrance. They moved Connor McGovern to center, promoted his backup David Edwards. Edwards was good last year in limited action and has previous starting experience. It's still shaky. FTN has him ranked as line 25. I think they're probably closer to 20. Now, let's pull up something from Spectrum Local News, a Buffalo station. Quote, this is Josh Allen's offense, right? This is Joe Brady. You're going to put together the offense around the guys that you got. For us to just say, hey, we're just going to scrap everything and everything was broken, that wasn't the case. There will be some elements of things that I believe in, but it's more like tell me who we have on our football team and the guys and what they can do well, and we're going to do that. End quote.
200 Josh Allen rush attempts.
Oh, boy. Now, COVID may have changed the entire world, but it's only helped Josh Allen's fantasy points per game numbers. How's that for a lead? Pretty good?
I think so. I think it's relevant.
Thanks. That'll be the sound clip. Since 2020, he's turned in fantasy finishes of quarterback 1, quarterback 1, quarterback 3, quarterback 1. Let the nerds predict a more run-heavy offense being bad for Josh Allen, but they're not. In the games he played with Joe Brady as offensive coordinator, he only finished outside quarterback 9 in one game. He averaged 24.6 rushing yards per game with Dorsey, but 47.1 with Brady. Pretty Yikes. Good. His numbers in terms of pass attempts, yards, ADOT, they're all wild. They're all over the place because Josh is going to Josh.
He's but good Jimmy G.
He's agent of chaos. One of the narratives that seem to hold true, though, they're going to call a game plan that asks the offense to exploit the weaknesses in the defense that they're playing. Dallas was the 5th best defense against the pass, but middle of the road in rush defense. Well, Allen only had 19 dropbacks, and he was still quarterback 17 that week. Anyways, Philadelphia had the 5th most yards given up to opposing offenses. Well, Allen had 57 dropbacks and was QB1 that week. Yep. Josh Allen had 15 rushing touchdowns last year and scored on 13.5% of his carries.
Yeah.
That's an insane return rate.
The only player in the league with multiple rushing touchdowns last year with a higher touchdown percent was Anthony Richardson, who had 25 carries. Josh Allen had 111.
Okay. Now imagine you got both of them on the same Superflex team.
Oh, God. Anthony Richardson only played how many games last year, though?
Three. Two full games.
Okay.
So, I don't want to spend more time on this than I have to. Is there another quarterback you want more in fantasy than Josh Allen?
Depending on the price, because what is he, a third rounder?
Let's get there. Real quick, though, I want to point out that, like, even when Diggs was playing and not getting fantasy points, it had no correlation to Josh Allen's fantasy success. Allen was QB5 in Week 11. Diggs, wide receiver 53.
Holy shit.
Week 12, Josh Allen, QB1. Diggs, wide receiver 15. Week 14, Josh Allen, QB9. Diggs, wide receiver 52. The Dallas game, he was quarterback 17. Diggs was 45th. Week 16, Josh Allen, QB2. Stephon Diggs, wide receiver 53. And it just keeps going. It doesn't fucking matter. Josh Allen is expensive, and rightfully so. It feels like he's being priced at his ceiling, but that's because he's hitting his head on the ceiling every year. So instead of doing the ranking thing, Waleed and I were debating about if he's being overvalued. I think he's not. Waleed thinks he is, and Waleed is never wrong. But our conversation came down to this, gentlemen. Would you take Josh Allen at the 2-3 turn or Patrick Mahomes at the 4-5 turn?
I want the ceiling every time.
Taking Joshy boy?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. That'd be a coin flip for me.
Fair enough.
I mean, to me, it's like, what are you getting at the 2-3 turn, right? Like, who am I giving up? Am I giving up, like, Garrett Wilson and Chris Olave?
Sure.
Right? Like, sure. I'll take the dude who's... I hate to, like, push the QB narrative, but, like, Josh Allen's going to put up 350 points on your team this year compared to, like, 280. So you can figure through this podcast, you can find the Puka Nacua of next year or this year.
Yeah. And I've got it coming up. So
let's go.
Not really, but I'm optimistic. So before we get there, James Cook ended up running back 19 in fantasy points per game last year due to a really nice second half of football. But when we're saying that, we're actually just talking about the four-game stretch from week 11 through 15, where he was RB10, RB12, RB3, RB2.
When it matters.
Even when he was at his hottest, he was still only running about 40% of his team's routes, and his season-long snap share was just over 55%.
That's really good efficiency.
Yeah, but he played all season. So, like, those raw numbers are 10th in carries, 4th in rush yards, 19th in targets, 8th in receiving yards, 2nd in yards per catch. The raw numbers are reflecting of the fact that he played all 17. The per-game stuff is kind of whatever. Cook is a playmaker, but he's always going to be the 1A in a backfield that uses a lot of different backs, all of which will get absolutely cucked by Josh Allen inside the 5.
Remember Latavius Murray?
I do. Josh Allen had 40% of Buffalo's rushing attempts inside the 5 last year.
Oh my God.
Of course.
Cook's breakaway rate was 30th in the league. And that's like percentage of runs that go over 15 yards. And he was giving up inside the 5 touches to Latavius Murray, who had more opportunities inside the 5 than James Cook did. James Cook's rushing touchdown rate last year was tied with Miles Sanders and Zach Charbonnet.
Wow.
Dude, receptions matter.
So I know touchdowns aren't sticky, but there's got to be context to the numbers. And when you think about it, Cook is still probably the second or third option on the goal line for the Bills, which hurts his upside. He's going to get primary carries. He's going to be the workhorse in weeks. He's going to be top 5 back a couple times a week. But as of right now, he's running back 15 on 4-for-4's aggregate rankings with a best ball ADP of 55. Gentlemen, James Cook or Kenneth Walker?
I'm going Walker.
That's tough, man. Like, ugh. We memed James Cook in irrelevancy 2 years ago, right?
Yep.
I think I'll go James Cook.
James Cook or Aaron Jones?
Cook.
Yeah, I'm not trusting that Minnesota run game.
James Cook or Joe Mixon?
Cook.
I go Mixon.
Sorry, I was just interjecting. What if we go with the narrative where, like, the coaches are like, all right, we need Josh Allen to stay healthy. All right, let's stop scrambling so much and stop running so much and utilize more of our weapons. Do you think that is a possibility, or are they just going to let him ball out and do whatever he wants?
I think he's going to choose to do whatever he wants. They could tell him to play the pocket, but I think he's such a tank and a himbo of a human being where he's like,
yeah,
I'm going to score a touchdown here. I don't give a shit.
Yeah. It's ever since he hurdled that dude in Minnesota,
he tries it 4 times a year, right? Like,
he's just like, fuck it. All right, speaking of shit that doesn't matter, Ty Johnson, 45 carries, 198 yards, 0 touchdowns last year. I guess his role in Ray Davis's might be similar depending on how the coaches view each, but if I had to bet on a Buffalo running back to get the Latavius Murray work, it's Ray Davis, who is a sneaky good pass catcher as well. There are 114 carries vacated in this backfield, and to see Davis and Johnson split them 50-50 or 60-40 would be cool for Davis, but neither of them are fantasy relevant. Holding Davis in Dynasty is recognizing that you're one James Cook injury away from having a starting running back, but who's to say if that role is even as juicy as we'd want it to be? All right. Buffalo wide receiver room. This puzzle's going to be a lot of fun, so we're going to take a stab at it.
One big shotgun blast.
Here we go. This is absolutely financial advice, so good luck. Joe Brady actually said he has no idea who's doing what at this point in the season, which is great. 302 targets vacated as Buffalo systemically took their wide receiver room apart piece by piece.
Yeah, right.
Allen's attempts per game went down when Brady took over, but even if we played it conservative and gave him 35 attempts a game on average, he's still cranking at 595. Like, that's a lot of pass attempts.
Yeah.
Now, Gabe Davis was on the boundary 84.5% of the time. Stephon Diggs was on the outside 63%. Khalil Shakir had 398 snaps out of the slot last year, while newly signed wide receiver Curtis Samuel had 399. It seems to me like we have redundant skill sets, but the way the offense aligns allows them to be flexible. However, Samuel, unlike Shakir, has logged seasons of 65%, 75%, and 71% on the outside in his career. Now, they were his first three seasons in Carolina, but we've seen him do it. Shakir was on the outside 21% of the time, so it's not as rigid as you might think, but whatever. So, it's time to go ahead and try to see where we're going with this room now that the table is set. The only returning vet to this offense, this room, is Khalil Shakir. He has a handful of metrics that he ranked first in last year, but hilariously, all of them are just metrics that describe how good Josh Allen is. Like, yeah, dude, Khalil Shakir, number one in target quality rating. Number one in catchable target rate, target accuracy. Like, yeah, those are Josh Allen stats, bud. you have to like how much his snap share rate went up once Brady took over, with just two games under 60% from week 11 through the playoffs. He's a solid bet to be up there in the rotation of receivers. Given his time with Allen and knowledge of the system, he's wide receiver 55 on 4-for-4's aggregator. That's pretty cheap cost of entry, and he could be snagged in best ball at pick 111.
Is he then the consensus number one wide receiver on that team then?
It's so funny because when I watch the bootleg sports one, they're doing like a who you should look at for fantasy, and they mentioned two wide receivers in this room, and neither are the ones that I care about. So let's get there. Okay. So first off, let's tell the story of Marquez Valdez-Scantling. He is a boundary deep threat with garbage hands and somehow was gone from role player in Green Bay and then given his top 2 years in terms of routes run with Patrick Mahomes and still turned in seasons of wide receiver 70 and wide receiver 109.
Yeah, that was really interesting experiment in Kansas City, but...
Dude, I remember doing Toucan's draft for him, and I was streaming it with Waleed, and it was like round six or seven. Waleed's like, take MVS. I was like, why would I do that, Waleed? I can get him 5 rounds cheaper. And guess what? He was a fab dude.
Yep. He's gone from Rodgers to Mahomes to Allen, and he still sucks. So not happening. Don't care. Now, Justin Shorter is a tall, big-ass motherfucker who was drafted in the 5th round last year and missed his whole rookie season with a hamstring. Don't care. Mac Hollins is a depth piece and a blocking wide receiver. Don't care. Chase Claypool is Chase Claypool. Moving on. Let's talk Keon Coleman, who got his flowers as a big contested catch winner in college. Pull up from the rookie guide. On one hand, there's games he completely takes over with his physicality, catch radius, yards after the catch. And on the other hand, there's a ton of film that highlights him dropping balls, losing in contested catch situations, and not separating on his routes. He's not a bad route runner, and when the play breaks down, he's a beast at finding the quarterback, rolling with him and getting open, but running a 4.64 shows on tape.
That's probably why they drafted him, right? Of like, hey, our QB is going to scramble. You got to scramble too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So to me, Keon Coleman would be most successful as a boundary wide receiver, lined up next to a true alpha in a pass-heavy offense. He can be a solid downfield threat, but is best at using his frame to box dudes out in the short or intermediate area. Now, the Bills traded back twice and still got him. This tells me that on an organizational level, they saw a wide receiver as something, hey, we got to take care of this, but we have so many holes that we'll tear down and get extra ammo for our little reboot right now. They gained two rounds in the draft. They turned a fourth to a third and a sixth to a fifth, and they still netted a dude that does have potential alpha ability. Coleman has a strong feel for the game. He can catch well on posts, slants, and digs. Reception perception shows him as a dude that struggles in man coverage and versus the press. So it's nice that he's complimented by Samuel, who was top 30 in fantasy points per route run versus man last season. Per reception perception and Matt Harmon, Coleman might be stronger in the slot, but there's too many of those guys on the roster, so he's going to struggle to fit unless he gets better against the press. Coleman has some things I like about his game. He's a bully. He can make acrobatic catches, and he's fucking nice with the ball in his hands. I'm not so certain that he's got a year one blow up in his, eventual whatever. But I do feel like as he develops, we could see him become the focal point of this offense in 2 or 3 years. Right now, if I was a betting man, I would put him down to be the third most targeted receiver, on this team. Keon Coleman. Keon Coleman was wide receiver 49 on 4-for-4's aggregator rankings and pick 49 in best ball.
Oh my God, dude.
I had to double check when I saw that. I'm like, am I reading this wrong? And so I went to a best ball draft that I was in, and he was taken at pick 63. You fucking degenerates.
People want a piece of that action, man.
Now,
yeah, they just see Buffalo offense and they're like, oh.
Now, I'm just gonna say it. Curtis Samuel is the guy you want in this room. Curtis Samuel is my sleeper.
Shout out Weremonkey.
I can see it.
I have been keeping this a secret for like 2 weeks. This is all I've wanted to scream this from the mountaintops. Curtis Samuel is the guy you want in this room.
Oh shit.
It's Curtis Samuel to Adam Thielen of this team.
Is he gonna, absolutely.
Is he gonna have top 15 weeks?
Let's get into it. Samuel had his best NFL season in Carolina when his offensive coordinator was Joe Brady. He caught 77 passes. 77 passes, 851 receiving yards, 200 rushing yards, 5 touchdowns, wide receiver 27 fantasy points per game.
Damn.
So when you say like, oh, Khalil Shakir knows the system, so does Curtis Samuel. Now, how big is his ceiling? Well, he's only had over 100 targets once in his career. But clearly this would be the best opportunity for him to get like 120, 110.
What quarterback was that the year in Carolina?
I think that was Darnold.
Was it Darnold? Was it?
No, it's probably Teddy Two Gloves.
That might be.
Oh, really?
Let's find out. Carolina Panthers.
They've had the new quarterback every year since I've been watching football.
I guess that's true.
It was Teddy Two Gloves. You called it.
That's right. I know ball. Finally,
you've always known ball. So they gave him 3 years and $24 million. All right, that's not huge, but like, it's also not a vet minimum contract. I still think he leads the wide receivers in targets. His ADOT left a lot to be desired in Washington and in the season with Brady in Carolina. But giving an older wide receiver a 3-year contract and then moving back repeatedly before taking Coleman tells me the team sees that their first and second targets were already on the roster. Pull up something from reception perception. He's cleared a 75% success rate versus man coverage in all 4 of his sampled seasons. He is an explosive separator in isolated coverage. 80% success rate versus zone last year, career best. 68.8% success rate versus press. And despite his size, Samuel has the tempo and explosiveness to get off the line. He is not a player who needs to work inside exclusively. End quote. He is by far the best route runner in this wide receiver room. He has the best yards after catch profile in the bunch. And he has experience being successful at all 3 of the wide receiver positions, which means they can use him just like they use Diggs all over the formation. Every year, the Bills had nobody beyond Diggs who could get open. Coleman is not a separator. Shakir is not a separator at all three levels. And Samuel is that dude. It's still early on in the process, but I'm all the fuck in on Curtis Samuel this year at cost. I don't think he's going to put up Stephon Diggs numbers, but I'm betting on him being a wide receiver too this season. I have 75% exposure in best ball so far.
Damn.
I don't think a lot of people will be as optimistic as you are about him too. So it might be a good chance for all of our listeners to get him some good value in the later rounds of drafts and stuff.
Yeah. He's currently wide receiver 53.
I think he's a good flex play, right? Like a guy you don't have to worry about, and like he's good for 10 points a week, right? I think that's a very fair investment and something like, what else are you going to take at that point?
Yep. He is going at around pick 99 on Underdog. So you're getting him around the eighth, ninth round. Now, let me just ask you then, Curtis Samuel or Josh Downs?
Ooh. Well, after your narrative, I'm going Samuel.
Yes.
I love Anthony Richardson. I love Shane Steichen. We'll get to them at a point in the season, but I am so terrified for that wide receiver room. It is not going to be Gardner Minshew show. So I kind of want to fade all Indianapolis Colts receiving weapons right now. So I'm going to go Curtis Samuel.
I am the bull god. Curtis Samuel or Brian Thomas Jr.?
Ooh. Damn, Tony.
Mm-hmm.
I'll go with Samuel.
My man.
Even though, you know, Thomas is a Jag, but it's unproven talent. So,
okay.
I want the ceiling. I want BTJ.
Okay. I'm assuming you guys will both go JSN over Curtis Samuel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Let me give out some flowers here real quick. In our 2023 rookie draft guide, our boy Shane called Dalton Kincaid number two on the Bills in targets. Sure enough, Kincaid was one of only two Bills to go over 100 targets if you include the playoffs, which I do. It's funny because I also said in that very same rookie draft guide that he wasn't a good enough blocker to be featured as a red zone threat. And sure enough, Kincaid did not score once in games that Dawson Knox also played in while Knox had three touchdowns.
Sheesh.
Yeah, that sounds bad. So, shout out to Jeff Crisco, Walker Kelly, Mike Valverde, and the FA pod this week for calling Dalton Kincaid overdrafted at tight end for some of the exact same reasons I'm about to get into. He is going to get juiced up, and he's already juiced up, as he's got what could be a lock to either be first or second on the team in targets. So, I get it. Those red zone opportunities might open back up, especially if Kincaid is on the menu to be a boundary option in the red zone. I don't know. Opening up this wide receiver room might also allow Kincaid to get over 65% of the snaps, which is something that he struggled to reach last year. You'd imagine that Brady runs more and possibly uses Knox and Kincaid at the same time, but Kincaid does look to once again get more targets and become a consistent asset at tight end. Kincaid actually only averaged 5.6 targets per game when Brady was the OC. And even though he had been killing it when Knox came back from injury, when Knox came back, they still went to a platoon. So if you think that Kincaid is going to be second on this team in targets again, go get you some. But I think this offense is going to disappoint when all the pass catchers get in the way of each other. Kincaid still hasn't shown to be utilized in the red zone. Knox hurts his snap share and upside, and none of his peripherals wowed me. Tight end 8 in targets, tight end 14 in target share, tight end 11 in routes run, tight end 7 in catches, and end of the year as tight end 14 in fantasy points per game. If you think that like a Trey McBride level ascension is coming, he's all yours. It's certainly possible, but if you're in on that, you got to pay up if you want it. Right now, he's actually tight end 12 on 4-4's aggregator, but pick 46 on Underdog.
Oh my God.
Really?
Yeah. So, gentlemen, Dalton Kincaid or Cole Kmet?
Ooh. No, I'll go Kincaid.
I think the price difference is where I want to play the difference, right? Like,
sure.
Because we're not talking like draft round, we're talking about tight end selection.
Well, and let's forget best ball. Let's talk like redraft here, where if he's already tight end and Cole Kmet is like, he's tight end 12 and Cole Kmet's tight end 15. which one, because it'll be closer in redraft than it is in best ball. People are reaching so they can stack with Josh Allen.
Yeah, I think I take Cole Kmet and just be like, I'll get this dude in the 12th round, right?
Okay. Dalton Kincaid or Dallas Goedert?
I got to go Kincaid again. I don't want to, but I have to.
Hey, man. 2022, the difference between tight end 8 and tight end 16 was 8 points. Going Dallas Goedert.
Okay. Dalton Kincaid or David Njoku, the Joker?
Well, seeing as how Flacco's not in Cleveland anymore, I'm going Kincaid again.
Yeah, okay. I'm here too.
Okay. And those are the 2024 Buffalo Bills. Before we go, let's run through the schedule. I hope you have your pens ready so we can get our win totals together.
Yeah, they're going to be 10-7, and then they're going to lose in the first round against the Chiefs. Just calling it out.
All right. Week 1, home against the Cardinals.
Win.
I'm calling that a loss.
Wow.
I'm believing in Kyler this year, dude.
Okay. Week 2, Thursday night at Miami.
Ooh. That'll be close. And I hope it's 42-38. But
how's their?
I think Dolphins come away with that.
How do our? I know we don't do defense on this podcast, but in your research, did you look at how their defense was ranked? Because it doesn't feel like they're that high.
Their defense was really, really bad against the run last year, but pretty good against the pass.
But they were also injured to hell again.
Yeah, and they have I think 3 new defensive back starters this year, so we'll see.
Yeah, I'm calling that a loss.
I agree. I think Miami takes the Thursday night game. After that, Monday night, at home, Jacksonville Jaguars.
Ooh. I don't think we're going to get any surprises just yet, so I'll go another win.
$55 million man, though, Ryan.
Trevor Lawrence got his money today.
That's right.
I'll go the Bills. It'll be ugly.
Okay, at Baltimore.
Loss.
L.
At Houston.
Man, this is a good season start.
Yeah, it's tough.
I have to give them the win. Another close game.
I think so, too. At the Jets.
Win.
I'm giving it an L. They always play them tight. It's Monday night.
They choke. They choke against that defense.
Yep. At home against Tennessee.
Win. W.
In Seattle.
A W.
I'll call the... You know what? I'm going to say that that's a loss because they're traveling to the West Coast.
Okay. Home against Miami.
Damn. Does Buffalo split with Miami this year, or does Miami win both games? I'll give them the split.
They're playing early, though, right? Because what is this, week 8?
This is November. Yep. This is, yep. Then they go to Indy.
I'll call that a win.
Yeah, it's a win.
Home against Kansas City.
They beat him in the regular season, right? They just can't. They can't beat him in the playoffs.
Yep.
They're in Buffalo.
Yep.
And it's the middle of the season, so it's not cold yet.
I'm going W.
I'll go Buffalo win.
Okay. Then they have a bye over Thanksgiving week. December 1st, at home against San Francisco.
Ooh.
Sunday night.
I'm going loss.
I'll go win.
It's a dub for me. At SoFi against the Rams.
W.
I'm going to win.
I'm going win as well. They are going to Detroit.
L.
Ooh. In the Pontiac. Yeah, I have a loss.
In the Pontiac. home against New England.
W.
Yeah, that's a win.
Drake May meeting future Drake May. Home against the Jets.
I'll go loss. I'll have them split against the Jets.
I'm going W because this is their wild card push where they have to lock it in.
Sure. And then last game in New England.
W.
Win. I believe I have them at 11 wins.
I have 12-5. They'll do worse than that.
Saying 10-7, dude.
I think 10-7 is reasonable. So yeah, that's the Buffalo Bills. All done.
Cool.
No more Bills.
All right, dude. So
let's take a break.
Yes.
Come back. Dallas, Denver. We're partying. We'll see you on the other side.
Woohoo.
And goodbye.
It'll always be a Chacombe Avenue to me.